Last time, in our last lecture, we were screaming about the United States government and its many failings. I want to make clear something, unfortunately, in the current context, I must tell you that many of you who came here to hear a course on philosophy and human values probably expected more philosophy and less on the human value side. Well, I hope some of you were here yesterday when I ran through a series of ethical theories. And I think I gave some arguments. That was my professionalizing work. In other words, that was the display of my rough credentials to do this. Now I'm on to a topic of which I consider, and so far, in a way, it's just groundwork for the other stuff. Because all of the great ethical theories of the past, in a way, do contain utopian moments. In a way, being a Stoic, an Epicurean, being someone who pursues excellence are all interesting and historically recoverable, in a certain sense, projects. What I pointed out today is that the situation in which we find ourselves in modern life, in the present, means that there are other conditions that must be met to even pursue those projects. So I don't see the two sets of remarks as different as you might think. It's not as I did philosophy one day and politics the next, because such watertight distinctions are not viable between philosophy and politics. Again, before I return to Marx, let me try to indicate that the priority of politics is marked even in the Greeks, where the last thing that Aristotle wrote was a constitution for Athens. He wrote that, you know, last, after he had written the metaphysics, the physics, the logic, and all this. I have a feeling that he thought that constitution as important as anything he wrote. We certainly know about Plato writing the Republic, that remark about the best kind of state, and that debate in Plato is certainly as important as anything he wrote. So, in a way, even the classic philosophers, the ones that the people from the National Association of Scholars love, understand that politics, as it were, sets those boundary conditions and those necessary conditions within which human beings can pursue things like a good life for themselves. And so those are the conditions that I was discussing last time and trying to discuss them in the context of the present. And for that, I found Marx helpful in one respect. I want to point out something about that, though. There is a severe problem with the writings and the work of Marx that's all too obvious to us today, and that's that the assumption that workers shaping and forming their own modes of work wouldn't fall victim to the power of the state, which would now step in place of a capitalist class, exploit their labor in the same way, not exactly in the same way, you know, they'd use different words and all that. As I say, pretty much from the bottom, it's hard to tell the difference. But, you know, they'd use a different ideology. But his expectation that the state would do more than administer and would actually control the life of people was an absolute blind spot in his work. But then look at our liberal theorists. For them, an equal blind spot is that while they pay lip service to wanting to constrain the state, you know, and let free enterprise flourish, that led, when it was tried, and it hasn't been tried in a long time, when it was tried, it led to a great, deep, worldwide depression that scared the capitalist class so much that no one's ever tried it again since. And no one plans to. President Reagan came into office promising to shrink the size of the state. As you may know, as a matter of fact, it's larger than ever. So that the process of a world becoming bureaucratically more complex and intrusive at the level of the state is a world phenomena. It's not localizable. The process of an economy becoming ever more diverse, commodifying ever more sections of our lives, until we replaced the Sunday stroll, to use another example. I mean, I'm old enough to remember that when I'd go with my granddad, we'd go for a stroll on Sunday. Well, that can't be done now without a relation to the commodity. Well, it could be, but rarely is. We're socialized to go for a stroll someplace else on Sunday now. The mall is open in the afternoon, and even in North Carolina, after church, they open it up, after church. You stroll through the mall so that you can both stroll and shop. Sort of the strolling aspect is still important. I mean, I'm not saying that it's not kind of kinky to walk around and watch people buy things. It's amusing. So I don't want you to think that Marx has a critique of capitalism only, and that's all I'm interested in. The critique of the state and the state bureaucracy is also important. And I've mentioned the name of Max Weber, but I didn't bring in any of his books. They're real thick, real boring, and I've suggested that a sense for what a modern bureaucracy is like can be evoked from reading the novels of Franz Kafka. Things like Before the Law and The Trial give you more of a sense of being caught in a modern bureaucracy. And all of you have that sense anyway. If you've moved to a new city and tried to hook up a telephone, and they say, go to room 238. You go to room 238, and they say, where'd you come from? Who'd you talk to? You go, I forgot. They go, oh, no, you'll have to go back to room 104. You go to 104. 104 says, you've been to 232. Well, you can't come to room 104. We all know this. And so for that, that's what modern bureaucracies look and feel like, you know. So for that, go to Kafka. So what I was trying to develop last time was a criticism of the state and the economy, of a new arising global order that now, I guess, has become popular enough to deserve the moniker New Order. A new order. I'm always suspicious of new orders. So now I'm going to drop back a level and look at some of the other factors that go into it, into the formation of human values other than, although I still think these are crucially important, other than the economic ones. And for that purpose, I just can't restrain myself from looking at a couple more of the critics of modernity, you might call critics of modern life, of the modern state, the modern economy, and of the conditions in which our modern culture is formed. And one of those critics that I think has come under fire in Time magazine and elsewhere is Nietzsche. You may have heard of him, Nietzsche. It's very popular now to see Nietzsche as sort of the new threat. You know, in the 60s, the right wing was worried that too many college professors read Marx. They don't worry about that anymore. People like Jan Ilster run huge institutes. They're analytic Marxists. That's respectable. Now you're looked at sort of, it's a little funny, if your interest is in Nietzsche. And I'll try to explain first what's supposed to be so scandalous about Nietzsche. Nietzsche is supposed to hold the scandalous view that knowledge is a form of power. Now, that's scandalous because knowledge is knowledge. It's objective, you know, like journalism. And it would be scandalous to show that wherever we find knowledge, we will find it structured and constructed around a system or systems of power. Won't find one without the other. Now, one can think of this along the simplest pedagogical models. By that, I mean the classroom models. I mean, I ought to know this from teaching the university. I know how to pass along knowledge. To get someone to believe me in the last analysis, I give them an A, which I could replace with a happy face. They're used to that. That's from kindergarten. They're both just symbols, right, of achievement. They're not getting paid for this stuff, right? You just give them a little A. They smile. That same system starts in kindergarten. Happy face, A, runs through there. F, no face. Blank. Same thing would work in kindergarten. That form I use looks fair. I mean, I'm grading objectively. But the point is deeper, that what the knowledge is based on is my spot of power as the teacher. That's what it's based on. Now, you would go, oh, no, it's based on what's really true. Yeah, but how does that get meted and how does that get meted out and parsed out? Who decides that? Well, the blunt and ugly answer is, we do. The teachers do. We decide. Now, there are clear counterexamples to Nietzsche's argument. In mathematics, at its simplest levels, I will grant you that if we're doing a mathematics course, I can grade objectively. But I will also grant you that nothing of great importance to human values hangs on truths that everyone can accept. That 2 plus 2 is 4, that A is A, are all acceptable, and they're acceptable precisely because nothing of very great human importance hangs on them. The moment you go a little beyond that in any direction, even in math class, when you discuss, for example, the philosophy of mathematics, then the disputes start, and then power at some point has to insert itself and decide. So an important part of Nietzsche's investigation is in the interconnection between forms of knowledge and power. For purposes of our course, forms of ethical behavior and power are the subject of his most important book. Well, maybe not his most important, but certainly the most the most coherent, on the genealogy of morals by Nietzsche. And in this book, and I'm going to talk about it just briefly, Nietzsche talks about not what's right and wrong in the way we did in previous lectures, good or bad actions, but the word genealogy talks about what were the origins of the situations within which we make the value judgments. In other words, from where did this distinction come? Good, bad, right, wrong, and so on. Now, Nietzsche's argument is rather abrasive. It's certainly provocative. And the genealogy of morals traces the moral form of discourse, good, bad, right, wrong, back to originally, and again, this is these 19th century Germans again, back to the Greeks. Now, here Nietzsche talks about the Greeks as having, and the word he uses is very important, and this will move us finally back to our account of the present. Nietzsche talks about the translation of virtue. What was virtue for the Greeks? Nietzsche was a philologist who could never get a normal job as a professor because he was a little nuts, okay? And anyway, that wouldn't have stopped him now, but it stopped him then. For the Greeks, virtue, when I said the word, I could see all of you go, oh, virtue. Yeah, it wasn't like that for the Greeks. I've already given you the Greek ideal of Odysseus, where virtue included the ability to be a clever liar. In other words, knowing when and who to con was important. That's not part of the Victorian idea of virtue, but it's part of the Greek ideal of it. And so virtue for them meant this excellence in being well-rounded. It meant to be excellent at revenge, so that unlike the Christian ideal of virtue, if someone strikes you, you strike them back, and the reason you do that is because if you don't, it will offend them worse. It will hurt their honor and yours. Much more virtuous to hit them back, and then both your honors are intact. If you humiliate them to turn your face as though they were unworthy scum, now hit them back. So Nietzsche discusses this use of virtue, and the Greek evaluation he calls noble. Now, noble for Nietzsche is not itself a term of value, but a kind of descriptive term of the way the Greeks evaluated. And he himself is not doing ethics the way I was doing it the other day. This is not. He's giving, as it were, a genealogy, a history of the way in which we've come to use these words. For Nietzsche, the key movement in the way the words good, bad, right, and wrong occur around the word virtue, and occur with the Christian transformation of virtue from something active based on excellence into something filled with what Nietzsche calls resentment. And I guess there's a simple way to make the argument, and I'm trying to keep my remarks here at a level where they are debatable. What he means is something like this. For the Greeks, you know, someone who was strong enough to sin went ahead and sinned, which meant they did what they wanted to and enjoyed it, and for the Greeks, that was good. The Christian idea of virtue, which includes the idea of guilt and sin, meant that you want to do something real bad and you don't, and you're frustrated and filled with resentment towards those sinners who go ahead and do what they want to do. And you turn the name of your fault, cowardice, into a virtue. Really, you just didn't have the guts to go ahead and do what you wanted to do. Trying to make it sound even slimier than it is. But this is Nietzsche's argument. You didn't have it where the strengths to go ahead and pursue what you really wanted. And so your name for that inability is your virtue. You didn't do it. That's right. Well, we know that doesn't work out frequently because we have several notorious cases. The Jimmy Swaggart case shows that the most virtuous sometimes fall. But it's worse than that. As Nietzsche says, this Christian notion of virtue is a double trap. Because let's suppose someone who has the strength to pursue excellence goes ahead and does what they want to do and finds satisfaction. Then, because the whole field within which right and wrong is understood in the Christian era is different than the whole field within which right and wrong is understood in the earlier period, when you go ahead and do that, then you pay another price. Guilt. That's where you internally torment yourself for the very paradoxical and perverse reason that you did what you wanted to do. You go, damn, I'm so bad, I did what I wanted to do. You don't do what you want to do, and you feel, as it were, helpless, but a little bit smug, and then resentful towards others that do otherwise. That's resentment. Or you go ahead and do it, and then feel guilty and have resentment towards yourself. So Nietzsche talks about this reversal of values as a reversal of values from the Greek values. And the key word is virtue. Virtue is very differently understood in the Victorian era. And this is what Nietzsche talks about in the Genealogy of Morals. Is one of the things the argument does, whether you like it or not, or whether you accept it or not, and I've only outlined it in a kind of a snide, quick way here today, whether you like it or not, the interesting part of Nietzsche's project is that what we could see, and I haven't done that in here, but what we could have presented as eternal problems of morality, in Nietzsche's account, we become very aware that these so-called eternal problems change radically depending on where you happen to be in history. What gets called good is different if you happen to be in one society or one historical period and in another. Now, that seems like the shocking claim that it's all relative, right? That's where Nietzsche's supposed to be so abominably bad for a real humanistic education, that it's all relative. Well, this is not a part of the argument. What Nietzsche is trying to show is that knowledge, truth, objectivity, and good and bad have conditions for possibility. And those conditions for possibility change. That doesn't destroy what seems to be someone who lives in the Victorian period's right to call someone a sinner. In fact, it's a condition for the possibility of them doing it. You see what I mean? It's not that everything is relative. It's that there are conditions within which evaluations take place that themselves require analysis. In other words, his account is not a moral theory, but it is a theory about how we have come to have the moral theories we do have. How we've come to have the ones that we do have. Freud paid a tremendous compliment to Nietzsche. Freud said that Nietzsche knew more about himself than any other human had ever known or was ever likely to know. Fairly smart guy, I guess. Nietzsche wasn't very bright. His main target was Christianity, and I'm going to now we're going to return to a more contemporary critique of Christianity. And in this lecture, I'm going to present a little bit of Nietzsche's critique of Christianity. And the reason I'm going to do it and how it's connected with my earlier remarks is to this very day, in spite of the so-called secularization of the world, values, especially in the United States, in our culture, and again, we're working for a theory of the present, are still, by and large, Christian values. Those are the official public ones, right? The official public values. Again, the gap between how they're practiced and what they are, it's all a matter of dispute. But this, going out of the discourse of Hegel, there are other critiques, as I say, Nietzsche's is one. He focuses on the values that surround Christianity. So I'm going to talk about him a little bit more now. And then in the next lecture, I want to talk about a Christian who has a criticism of modern Christianity. So you'll get both sides. You'll get one guy who's sort of, you'll know before I'm through here, thinks Christianity was a mistake. From the standpoint of the species, it was a mistake. He goes, well, not quite, a 2,000-year mistake. I mean, it was more than that. It was a little bit more catastrophic. Nietzsche thinks that among the other ill effects of Christianity, one of them is very banal. It's the habit of bad reading. He explains how many of us are raised in churches where when we bother to read, now this won't hold for many of our Jewish friends or people who believe other religions, but in the Christian tradition, we're taught to read the Old Testament, where every stick of wood, every stone, every snake, every bird, every bat is a sign of Jesus. And Nietzsche points out that this inculcates in us habits of bad reading. It does. And, if you think about it, he says, well, now, in that book there, and then the preacher reads some just unintelligible piece of the Old Testament, the locusts have no king, they fly, and that means Jesus is coming. And you go, okay. Nietzsche says this makes you not read well. Being brought up this way tends to make you not read well. It's worse than that, however, and that's that what the way Christianity presents itself is as a doctrine of love and compassion. Certainly that has something to do with its appeal to our national character. And that's good, to a doctrine of love and compassion. Nietzsche's concern in this book, The Genealogy of Morals, is to show that what's beneath that mask of love and compassion is really a doctrine of resentment and hatred. And I think I can make that come alive for you with some pretty banal examples. One would be Jerry Falwell, who discusses homosexuals. He loves them. How many people believe he really loves them? See, I don't. I think he hates them. His way of hating them is to love them. That's the trick Nietzsche was after. The trick about how resentment, envy, and hatred can be masked with these words, love and compassion. It's an important argument today because I think we've become a suspicious culture. Nietzsche's been called one of the masters of suspicion. Paul Ricoeur, the philosopher, called him a master of suspicion. Ricoeur is a Christian as well. He just thinks that reading these books is the mediation through which any modern kind of faith would have to pass. You'd have to read them, understand them before you'd know what you meant by having faith. In any case, Nietzsche sees this dynamic of resentment and envy as being, as it were, the unspoken or the code beneath the code of Christianity. And so for the first time in the course, I'm going to pull out a section of a book that I want to look at, if I can find the correct quote here. This is from The Genealogy of Morals. In this edition, it's on page 48. It's section 15 of the first essay. Nietzsche's discussing Christian love, as it were, and faith, and hope. Nietzsche, in his rather cynical way, says, in faith in what? In love of what? In hope of what? These weak people, someday or other, they too intend to be strong. Have you ever heard an evangelist and got that feeling that while they were real meek, someday they intended to be real strong? Yeah, that's good. That's the idea. There's no doubt of that. Because they say their kingdom is coming. They term it the kingdom of God because, after all, one should be so humble in all things. To experience that kind of duplicity, one needs to live a long time. Dante, I think, committed a crude blunder when, with a terror-inspiring ingenuity, he placed the gateway of his hell, the inscription, I too was created by eternal love. At any rate, there would be more justification for placing above the gateway to the Christian paradise and its eternal bliss the inscription, I too was created by eternal hate, provided a truth could be written above the gateway to a lie. What constitutes the bliss of this paradise. Well, Nietzsche goes on to quote not Jerry Falwell, but St. Thomas Aquinas, great teacher, saint, certainly knew more about Christianity than I do or most of us. Thomas Aquinas says that the blessed in the kingdom of heaven will see the punishments of the damned in order that their bliss be more delightful for them. At that moment in Nietzsche's text, something sort of creepy should come up your back. You should go, St. Thomas Aquinas said that in heaven, our chief bliss would be that we could see all those mean people that got us while we were alive, having all that stuff ripped off of them eternally, forever. And Nietzsche's text wants to bring alive for us the barbarism, the hatred that must be buried in such a doctrine of love as its core. It's a very frightening argument, but it isn't limited, and I don't want to limit it, to a set of Christian values specifically, but to certain duplicitous ways in which words of value are used in general. The way that a bomb can be dropped lovingly, surgically. See, when you cut someone in surgery, you do it to heal them, right? That's what a surgical strike is. That's what a surgeon does. Cuts the cancer out, leaves the patient alive. So, but that's not all a surgical strike is, you see. This field within which good and bad appear so clearly to us, or are supposed to, I think some of us may be getting a little confused, but in which values are supposed to be so clearly appear to us, may very well have these duplicities built within them. A surgical strike may not be like surgery with Dr. Kildare. It could turn out there could be some resentment and hatred beneath it. There might be. It's possible. Nietzsche is not trying to argue demonstratively or to prove a syllogism, but rather to raise suspicions, to raise the kinds of suspicions that, as I say, I think many of us have when we look at the content of the values that have come up to us, through our traditions. That's what Nietzsche is powerfully and importantly good for. Not to deny, again, not to say all is relative, but to try to remind us of something of the origins of what we call good and bad, right and wrong, and so on. By the way, these values have come out in other contexts. I remember in an earlier war, General Westmoreland saying, we had to destroy the village in order to save it. But it was not an irony. He meant it. I mean, so did the early Christian communities that settled in this country mean it. That for a witch's own good, one had to dunk her repeatedly in water. Now, we've come a long way since then, haven't we? Because now we lock people away in prisons and in institutions, torment them with drugs, lock them up in the most dangerous environments, have more people in prison in this country per capita than any country in the world except South Africa. I don't know. They may be, the new South Africa may be ahead of us. Who knows? But we haven't gotten as far ahead in this regard as we think, and this argument has been updated by people like Michel Foucault. We still have the idea that we would send someone to prison in order to rehabilitate them. Now we're getting to be more honest about that. We're getting a little more barbaric, and for Nietzsche that would be better. That'd be a little more honest. We're sending them to prison because we're scared of them and that we know if they go there, really bad things will happen to them and it will ruin their lives and that will make us happy. That's what we should say when we send one to prison. If you know, to be honest, and as Nietzsche said, in the name of minimal honesty, don't send them to prison and go, ah, oh, that was the best thing for them. You know, you were spanked by your father maybe once. They just beat the hell out of you, and you went, that hurt me worse than it did you. And you go, I guess. Reading the text of Nietzsche makes us suspicious of people who do things for our own good. It makes us suspicious of people who love us, you know, in a kind of abstract way, especially. So I didn't want you to think that I had sort of, in my previous lecture, sort of become soft-hearted. So that's why we followed up with the Nietzsche lectures. We don't want any conservatives saying, well, you're not tough-minded enough. So this is sort of a little bit more of the tough-minded part. Just a sort of Christian doctrine of loving everyone, Nietzsche says, does not work. Because love is meaningless without discrimination. In other words, in what way do I honor you to love you if I love everybody else too? See, there are many points like that in Nietzsche that I think are quite challenging and quite interesting. It is absolutely, for Nietzsche, duplicitous to go, I just love everyone. Well, you haven't met everyone. And some of them you're not going to like because they're asses. You're not going to like them. And if you did, the people you really loved ought to be irritated because you'd say, well, I thought you loved me. You love everybody? Well, big deal. I'll see you later. I mean, you know. You bump into me again, you'll still love me, you know. It's like Will Rogers, I never met a man I didn't like. Well, he never met George Bush, you know. So Nietzsche is a wonderful, and all I can do is, because his argument is intricate and powerful, I'm just giving you suggestive bits of it today. But Nietzsche's one of the modern masters of suspicion, the reading of whose books, I think, warns us against some of our, as it were, not prejudices, because it's not fair to call something a prejudice that's so deeply seated, you know, that is so much a part of our civilization and culture. It's not really a prejudice, but it is an eye-opening experience to get, as it were, another look at it, a look at what might be beneath it. And so to get ready for my remarks on Nietzsche today, it was simply enough, as I say, to switch around unfortunately, I had to read this stuff before, all this, probably when I was too young. But switch around and hear Oral Roberts discuss how much he loved everybody out in TV land and that 10 big enemies were coming after all of us. Well, he didn't name any of them, so it's not very helpful. I mean, if you knew who they were, you could call the cops or something, I guess. Those are peace officers that carry weapons. Like Patriot missiles, peacekeepers. But to hear Oral and the various morning preachers, and of course in the case of Falwell, I think it's just outstanding because Falwell always loves his enemies. And the duplicity in it is palpable. And I just think that someone would have to be incredibly naive not to feel it almost. Especially if you've seen me in debate with some leader of, for example, a homosexual group. And he says, I love you. Just know that somewhere in there is the desire to inter everyone. More importantly, in the very texts that form the Christian tradition, like Thomas Aquinas, are these frightening moments that look marginal to the main tradition. But I don't think anyone's going to raise their hand and tell me St. Thomas Aquinas is a marginal figure in the history of Christianity. These blinding moments of clarity where we have these people say, the chief pleasure will be to see the torments of the damned. I mean, why will heaven be a lot of fun? Well, we'll be there a long time. And it'll be like a Clive Barker movie. All the people we didn't like will be being torn apart, you know, like in one of those Clive Barker films. And that will be a lot of fun. It'll be an ongoing splatter movie mixed with heart music. It'll be a real gig, a trip. It will be fun. Well, anyway, Nietzsche's discourse would teach us to be a little bit more honest about this, I think. And when we intend to punish or kill people, it would be nice to say we intend to punish or kill them. By nice, I mean not moral. We're in this moral universe where duplicity is built into being virtuous. Still, you see how I said earlier for the Greeks, telling lies well was sort of openly acknowledged as something clever to do. But that duplicity is still built into the concept of virtue in a way. I mean, we can't really tell the truth even about wars, as you know. We can't really let it all hang out and say, well, you know, we started off just to invade Kuwait and get it back, but now we're really pissed. and we want to kill all those damn Arabs, every one of them, man, that damn Saddam, and any of those other people that are yelling and burning our flag, too. Well, I've been out and around the country, and that's the attitude out there. It's not, it's funny, it's sort of the lower you go down the educational scale, the more honest it gets. It's kind of, that's sort of nice. At the university, we have a lot of professors who believe the same thing, who just won't say it that way. They believe it, they just won't say it. Instead, they'll do a sort of General Haig kind of discussion of it, the way Al Haig talks, sort of in State Department ease, full of lots of ing words and coinages that are not found in the English language, that, you know, just cover over the real situation, when what Al Haig really wants to say is, I'm in charge, and the dark little people will die. That's the message. And it's right and good that they should die, because they will die so that everyone can be free in a new world order, and right on, let's go get them, kick butt, drop bombs, they die, don't talk, kill. So like, it's like a proposal for surrender. A proposal for surrender as follows. You surrender or we bomb you while you sit there, but of course if you get up to leave, we will bomb you while you're walking away. Is that a good policy? See, that's almost Nietzschean, isn't it? Surrender, but don't move. Of course, if you don't move, you won't have surrendered, so we'll have to bomb you. But if you move, we won't be sure you've surrendered, so we'll have to bomb you. So surrender, but we'll bomb you. It's kind of a policy designed to do what? Bomb people. They can go, don't, but it won't help, because they'll either have to be still or moving, or some condition in between. Again, it'd be better openly to say, now that we've got this thing going, we're all good Christians, we want to do the right thing, and we're all believers in good democracy, but for the moment, let's forget it. This is too much fun. Let's really hammer them. And let's prove that our version of the Peloponnesian War, the one that made the Greeks so confused about their values, in our culture, we had a war like that that confused us about our values. Vietnam, and it's kind of a background theme of the current war, of a philosophy of the present, to which I'm now connecting the discourse of Nietzsche, loosely. A target might be to kill the guilt and the fear that were produced by that other troubling moment in history. Nothing would do that better than a clean kill with a huge majority for it. A quick clean kill. What better basis on which to build a new world order than an order of barbarism? I mean, you know, than this massively quick and effective barbarism, which would accomplish what should be openly stated as a public goal of the war. Namely, to prove that the peace love hippies were wrong and Rambo was right, and that is that in that earlier war, if only we'd have just kept bombing and hit them with everything we had, those damn peaceniks and those newspaper guys and all those bleeding hearts wouldn't have lost the war for us. Well, if we can go in now and show that massive force continually applied will bring this country to its knees, it'll be a way to demonstrate that that could have been done before. That all those people that raised all that hell were even more wrong than they've already admitted. Good God, even more sold out than they're already sold. It's like the New World Order can't tolerate even a little, just a little bit of opposition. And that may be true of it. Because it is, I don't know if it's Nietzsche's view, but it's mine, that systems of power connected to systems of value tend to spread and become total. In other words, they tend to want to fill up the total field of discourse within which we discuss the moral. This is well known about religions. Helps to account for religious wars. The principle of toleration is not built into people who have that kind of insight into the truth. That's why I did begin these lectures by discussing fallibilism, not as some deep philosophical principle, but as the following principle, that it's okay to have beliefs, but suspect your own beliefs. That it's important to believe some things passionately, but it's also important to have the wisdom to know that you could be dead wrong. So, using Nietzsche to bring up this critique of some of the values that have come out of the so-called Christian tradition, I realize that I could be wrong, Nietzsche could be wrong, but all these arguments and from him and the suggestions I've made during this hour are meant to do are to suggest a kind of suspicion of that tradition. Now, Nietzsche does say what is the powerful, one of the powerful motivations behind Christianity, which is I've argued is deeply connected to the current world system. One of its powerful motivations is it does speak to something that's very important, and human beings may, in fact, quite generally share it, and that's the need for love. Christianity is a sort of lyrical religion in that respect. It speaks of love. And it's hard not to know that it fudges the distinction between the earthly and the carnal kind. It fudges that distinction. I don't know how many of you have ever been to an evangelical meeting out in the country. But that's the night when all the men and women get dressed up in their best clothes and go and sing these rousing songs and sweat in their best perfume and sing "Love Lifted Me." And it's very difficult not to see Nietzsche's point that Christianity has always been a find for those who have repressed sexuality. It's quite a find. It always has been. So all I can do is suggest you read more Nietzsche. In a cynical time like this, it's hardly necessary. Most of you are probably already that cynical anyway. Maybe this was a waste of time. But I wanted to add to the economic and political conditions what might be called cultural conditions, of which religion remains an important one. And so the discussion of Nietzsche fits there. And also it fits because it's still a project for some and a quite serious one. So now that I've presented Nietzsche's rather cynical view, in the next one I'll discuss Kierkegaard's view. But the problem with this is that Christianity, as I already argued, in a modern society, is already a very idiosyncratic project. Very idiosyncratic. I know that because I've been a faculty in residence and lived with students at a university and had them come in and complain, "My roommate's a real sky pilot," by which they mean he reads the Bible a lot and irritates them. And that's an easier way to get rid of a roommate than coming in and saying he's a Nazi. Because the Nazi will just put up some swastikas in the room and use some words you don't like. The other guy will be up praying and irritating you all night. But Christianity I've been discussing here is not Christianity in the intimate sense of faith that I'll discuss when I do briefly discuss Kierkegaard, another critic of modern times. But that Christianity that has become a public religion, about which I guess the briefest Nietzschean critique would be that it's hokum as a public religion. It is important to politics. Harry Truman, I think, is quoted as saying that in our system, to run for political office, you have to pour God and Jesus over everything like ketchup over your food. It's just got to be covered up in it. Now, Carter was a different story. Someone said I had to say something about Jimmy Carter. In any course on ethics, you've got to talk about Jimmy Carter. And all I can say about Jimmy is he's a good Christian, but he did admit that he lusted in his heart after other women. If he had had courage enough, he would have been Ted Kennedy. And if Ted Kennedy had had the courage of Nietzsche, he would have said, "Yeah, I did it, and I liked it, and you would have too, if you'd have been there." Which is probably true. Don't you see? I'm not really trying to be cynical here. It's probably right. Nietzsche isn't trying to be just cynical to irritate you folks. I mean, that's probably right. Yes, you know, if you're rich, good-looking, and lots of people, yeah, sure, why not? So there's like a distinction there. There's sort of Kennedy, Carter, and then way down at the end of the spectrum is Richard Nixon. Is it almost question time? I really don't know what other nasty things to say about folks.